Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and I'm here with Russ Chianelli. And today we have a guest who's going to talk to us at least a little bit about the Dust Bowl. And, of course, for the older generation, the Dust Bowl and the Second World War.
What teams are going to play in the Dust Bowl?
The Pans versus the Brooms. And for the older generation, I suspect the Dust Bowl and the Depression that was there at the same time and the Second World War were two pivotal pieces of recent history.
We are very happy to welcome to Science Studio Professor Jeffrey Lee from Texas Tech in the Department of Economics and Geography. Welcome to Science Studio, Jeff.
Well, thank you.
Well, it's interesting. I think that economics and geography, I presume, can go together, but I suspect in this case it's simply a marriage of convenience because the university was trying to save money on chairman or something like that.
That's the way it works, but there is a whole subdiscipline of economic geography, and so the potential is there for.
And is that your speciality?
That is not mine. I'm a physical geographer. I overlap a lot with geology.
Jolly good. So let's first of all learn a little bit about Jeff Lee. How did you get into geography? I mean, I must say that was my love when I was a little boy, but what was your driving force for this, for an academic career?
Being an American, we had very little geography in school. So when I arrived at the university, a friend's older sister told me what classes I should sign up for, and I was told there's a great teacher of human geography at Cal State Northridge where I went. And I went to sign up for that, and it was closed, but they said, well, this physical geography class is open. And I said, well, I need something. And I went in, and he taught us all about the natural environment, and I thought this was wonderful. I didn't have a clue what any of this was about. And for me, it was an excuse to go camping and look at the stuff we were talking about.
Well, that's wonderful.
That led me into geography.
But before that, you went to college with a goal.
I was a fairly clueless 18-year-old. If somebody made me make a decision, I probably would have said I'll be a sociologist or an anthropologist.
Okay. When you had this physical geography class, which, as I understand it, means mountains, rivers, forests, right?
Right. No states and capitals or major resources.
So what was the one thing you said, I've got to go there first, that really intrigued you, like Brazilian jungle or?
No, I was in Southern California. I wanted to get back up into the mountains. I'd been a Boy Scout, and so we did our backpacking trips in the Sierra Nevada, and I'd spent a little time in the desert, and that's where I spent all my vacations.
So your preference really is to be up in the mountains. I ask that because my preference is to be on the beach in warm weather.
Now, beaches are very nice, too. I'll take a desert. High mountains are fine, too, and it didn't take me long after moving to West Texas to love the plains.
You're a geographer. You're a physical geographer. What does that mean nowadays in sort of modern North America? When a student says, I want to be a geographer, a physical geographer, what's the driving force for that, apart from desire to like?
Most of it is students interested in environmental science and not wanting to get too focused. Because in physical geography, like all geography, the big secret is you do anything you want to, and if you can put it on a map, you can call it geography. I can wear a hat as a climatologist one day and a geologist another day and a hydrologist another day,
so
bring in the human element as well.
You're a little interdisciplinary army.
That's what
you collaborate with yourself as a hydrologist, as an environmentalist, and
that's what geography is all about. It's pulling it all together.
You could argue that this is interdisciplinary. It's better to interact with a hydrologist or with a whatever.
I would say we need some people who are spread thin, who can talk to lots of other groups that are too narrow.
For example, I was reading the other day that China's three main rivers will not reach the sea by, 2030 because of what they're doing there.
Massive dam construction. That's certainly not my area of expertise, but they'll solve some problems and cause more.
But so, that could be a discussion for a class or a research
physical
geography.
Oh, yeah.
Where did you read that, Russ? I haven't read that.
Maybe it was The Economist. I'm not 100% sure, but this whole thing about by 2030 the world population will be 9 billion. That's the real problem.
That's another issue. Yeah,
but in terms of physical geography, there's questions like this all the time: the cutting down of the rainforest, the rivers not going to the seas, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, I'm just trying to stretch the span of the thinness here, which would include politics and economics.
Sure, natural resource use, absolutely.
But you're concentrating, or your one of your expertises is on the historical aspect of the Dust Bowl and
sure.
things of that nature. So why don't you sort of give us a brief history of when that became apparent that it was going to happen and the duration and a little bit of background for those of us that aren't totally familiar.
The Dust Bowl has different meanings to different people, but it's a region of the Texas Panhandle, Oklahoma Panhandle, western Kansas, eastern Colorado, and eastern New Mexico. And in the 1930s, several things came together to create the worst dust storms this country has ever seen. Just horrendous walls of dust coming through. People would get lost trying to get from their barn to their house. People died from inhaling too much dust. Lots of livestock died. Crops failed. It was just a nasty time to be around in that region. And the Dust Bowl region was probably where it was worse, but the entire Great Plains was going through the same situation well up into Canada.
And the implication was that this was sort of, I won't say out of the blue, but I mean, we get dust storms where we are in
sure.
West Texas today, but they're not quite as horrendous as you noted. But had there been previous examples of pretty horrendous dust storms in the previous 100 years, for example?
There have always been dust storms on the Great Plains,
right.
just as there always have been in El Paso.
So what was the cause? Why was this period so bad?
The way we see it, it was three things coming together in the 1930s. The way farmers were farming, the advice was have a layer of loose material on the surface to prevent evaporation. But loose material sitting on the surface, if the wind gets to it, is ready to blow.
Was then, normal tilling.
Normal tilling.
And now we have no-till for this problem.
Some are doing no-till, and that's one of the reasons we have no-till, is not to do that. And there are ways of tilling that we have learned that can do much better in terms of preventing erosion. But in the 30s, you had this loose material on the surface. Farmers had to work the soil on a regular basis, and they were all tremendously in debt. World War I came along. Crop prices went sky high. Lots of people moved out onto the plains to farm, and they made decent money early on. Through the 20s, they were expanding the size of the farms and getting rid of their mules and buying tractors, so suddenly they had mortgages. And they were in debt, and then the Great Depression strikes in 1929. Most of the 30s were bad case economically.
So this means they were trying to till more lands?
In some cases, they were trying to till more to do better.
What fraction in 1930 of the land in this area was farmed?
I don't have exact numbers. I would say 75-80%, and that's just off the top of my head. So farmers were in debt. It cost money to maintain their fields. And then the third whammy was the drought that hit in the 1930s. It wasn't the worst drought we've ever seen, but it hit at the wrong time. And so crop prices dropped tremendously. Not only could farmers not grow much, what they could grow they couldn't get much money for. They still had payments to the bank, and so they weren't able to take care of their fields, or many were not able to take care of their fields. All that loose material was just exposed to the wind. We get lots of nice windstorms in
was
the
this
Great
a
Plains.
Particularly bad drought period for 5 years, 10 years, or something like that?
It lasted much of the 1930s.
So you try to find out whether it's the farmer's fault or Mother Nature's fault.
A lot of people want to pigeonhole it into one or the other. It was all of it coming together. The recent work, some people have tried to figure out this 1930s drought, and modeling studies by very good climatologists suggest that you've got sea surface temperatures out in the Pacific in combination with sea surface temperature changes going on in the Atlantic, and it changed the pattern of storms coming from the west across the country, and what was going on in the Atlantic basically shut off the moist air coming up from the Gulf of Mexico. We don't know exactly, but it could be that the storms were more intense, but we don't have good enough evidence to say that for sure. Some people have suggested that. and just the lack of moisture.
So nowadays when one talks about weather patterns, this famous La Nina and El Nino,
right.
were those in the 30s? Did people understand?
I don't think they understood that at the time.
No.
It was just a drought and you accepted that. But La Nina and El Nino is out in the Pacific,
right.
and it was not an extreme event in any way in the 1930s.
But the records,
in combination with other things,
right.
seemed to shut off the moisture more effectively.
Well, nowadays when you go through this region, you just see, or you did, it's less now, and we'll come to that in a moment, lots and lots of irrigation from subterranean water. In the 30s,
in the 30s,
that wasn't an issue.
You had a little windmill which gave you enough water to feed your livestock and maybe grow a vegetable garden. The main crops couldn't be irrigated.
Okay.
After World War II, we get much better equipment for irrigation.
I would have, which World War I developed a lot of chemical industries for phosphates. Were they using fertilizers that were commercial?
I think it was very rare to bring in
one of the reasons I ask that is that one of the problems that we've had today, which leads to no-till and other fertilizers,
sure.
is this dead zone at the mouth of the Mississippi,
sure.
which is due to soil and phosphates coming down the river.
Yeah, it's a case of solving one problem and causing others. No-till is very good for erosion control, but you have to use a lot of pesticides to keep the weeds down. Again, we use more and more fertilizer.
So then your interest, I mean, as you just expounded it, I mean, you're giving some rationales and reasons that have sort of
sure.
come post facto. Well, what is the direct application or implication today? Is your work and your study being able to direct policy to make sure things like this don't happen, and not just in North America but around the world?
We haven't gotten there yet, but we're certainly thinking
just
along
sort
those
of
lines.
Understanding.
Right. This was a major climate change, which we are going into in the future. And
maybe.
How did people adapt to it? And
maybe.
Maybe. All kinds of things we don't know about what the future is going to bring.
Let me ask you, do you have a research group working on this? Or how do you advance here?
I've been mostly working with Tom Gill, who's here in at UTEP, and various other colleagues who give us lots of advice.
And one of the reasons I ask that is, you know, the story you tell about the Dust Bowl and so on. Do you ever make your students watch The Grapes of Wrath?
I've never done that. Probably should. There are a few documentaries. Some of them are pretty good about the Dust Bowl, and we do watch those.
You're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Kinelli, Jeff Lee from Texas Tech. We'll be back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. We recognize that women bear the bulk of the burden when it comes to birth control.
One excuse for men is that they have very few options. In addition to condoms, the choice is either to abstain from sex or get a vasectomy.
And that's why scientists have been working for years on a male birth control pill. One new approach might just work and focuses on a small molecule called JQ1.
Since only mature sperm cells can fertilize an egg, researchers use JQ1 to stop an immature sperm cell from maturing. The results with lab mice were impressive.
Normally, for a sperm to mature, a protein called BRDT binds to specific areas on the genome that activate the genes necessary for maturing of sperm. When researchers injected mice with JQ1, the small molecule bound to BRDT, preventing the protein from turning on the genes responsible for sperm maturation.
The JQ1-treated mice had a 90% reduction in sperm count and reduced motility, leading to sterility. Here's the great part. Unlike many previous studies with hormone treatments, these mice didn't exhibit side effects such as lower or higher levels of testosterone. Plus, their sexual activity remained the same.
Importantly, then researchers stopped the JQ1 treatment and normal sperm development returned. At the highest doses, it took up to 3 months for sterility to be reversed.
This form of male contraception is still about a decade away from being ready. JQ1 is currently injected but needs to be delivered in a way men can easily use. It also needs to be tested in humans to rule out long-term negative effects, such as infertility or birth defects.
Soon, men may be forced to share the responsibility of birth control, which a lot of women will say is about time.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Kinelli, Professor Jeff Lee from Texas Tech University. He's studying and talking about the Dust Bowl. Okay, so those issues that you brought up, you know, the farming, the drought, and the economic depression that was going on at the same time, these were the three pivotal reasons that you're espousing for the reason we had a Dust Bowl incident and activity. That's been known since when? I mean, I'm not sure that was just discovered and published last year.
We've kind of known it, but economists have looked at the economic aspects of it. Climatologists have looked at the climate aspects of it. Agricultural people have looked at the agricultural. And I think we're making a contribution by pulling it all together. If you talk to people, it was a drought that caused it. It was the depression that caused it. It was farmers being stupid, and I'm not agreeing with that at all. But nobody's really tying it together and saying that it was a combination of factors.
So this research that you're doing then is really, it's literature and sociology. I mean, do you actually do experiments? Do you do analysis on old soil samples? Or give us a clue about the
modus operandi. For this, we are not doing. This is more taking a science eye and doing a history study.
Okay.
And filtering it through our science background because we're working in the mechanics of erosion and other studies that are much more scientific than what we're talking about.
Okay, so let's discuss a little bit about the more what you might call scientific experimental erosion, for example. It's a major issue around the world.
Sure.
What are your sort of foci?
At the moment, also with Dr. Gill here at UTEP, we are trying to identify where our dust comes from here in the El Paso region and up on the southern plains. And we are finding when the dust blew, seeing if we can get a satellite image. If it's a clear enough day, we can see the dust doesn't blow off the entire landscape. It comes from particular places, what are known as hot spots. And it may be a particular farm field that it's blowing off, or around here, a particular part of one of the dry lakes. We have a long way to go before we know the answers to all this, but just where is our dust coming from? Can we document that and see what land uses are involved, what soil types are involved, and so on.
So satellite imagery is a really key new tool that the
people
have up there in their armory.
Sure.
I could imagine there were some places that were never farmed where you could take cores.
That's possible. My father was in navigation school during World War II around West Texas, and he remembers seeing cemeteries in small towns that were maybe a foot higher than the surrounding landscape.
Oh, yeah.
And I need to get out and just do some of that.
The other thing I would think, too, is the ratio of small farmers was much higher then, right?
Absolutely.
Now we have huge farms.
Sure.
Now, I don't know how that affects the analysis, but
there's a bit of an argument among economists. Was it too many big farms? Was it too many small farms? Small farmers don't have the resources to have the right equipment. Big farmers have too much land to take care of. We don't know what the answer to that is.
Well, I mean, talking about modern farming, I saw a TV program several years ago where the fellow is sitting in the machine that goes around and does things, and he's looking at satellite images, and he sees, oh, the moisture content in the bottom left-hand field is down. I mean, modern farming at that level is an incredibly sophisticated. So we must have gone a long way to sort of eradicating the problems of bad farming practices, for sure, out of those three issues that you mentioned.
Sure. The Soil Conservation Service was started in the 1930s as a result of the Dust Bowl, and a lot of good research is done, and they taught farmers a lot about the best ways to reduce erosion, and that's one of the main reasons we have less.
Well, of course, one of the issues today is you're going to have to farm a lot more land to support the population coming.
Sure.
You know, I think this is a very interesting approach because there's another one related to this that I've been sort of fascinated by in Southeast Asia, but also Haiti, where recently many people were killed in Haiti because of the hurricane.
Sure.
But the reason was there's too many people on the island. They stripped it for heating and cooking of all the wood.
And their soil's gone and their agriculture is almost useless.
So this is an example, a modern example of another place, sort of what you're talking about.
But won't it be self-rectifying? I mean, you know, you won't have a lot of people living on a barren island unless dropping in food like the, well, we did in the New Guinea era.
They'll all be in London.
That'll warm the place up.
One concern we have for the future is irrigation is so massive on the high plains right. now, and in
just lack of water,
we're running out of water.
Yeah,
right. I mean, I remember when I first came to West Texas, I used to drive to Canada every summer for a vacation, and when I crossed the state line somewhere to the east of Portales and west of Lubbock,
sure.
I don't know where.
Yeah.
You went from what looked like desert into what looked like wheat fields, or you know, it was an amazing contrast. And then as I went subsequent years, that became desert and then dusty fields and then agriculture. So the point being that the agriculture was sort of restricting itself or retracting into the state. So obviously that was to do with water, I suppose.
Right. I don't know how widespread that is. I have a colleague at Texas Tech working on just when will we run out of water from the Ogallala Aquifer.
Right.
And in some places where it's most intensively irrigated now, they may start running out in 10, 20 years. And then if you don't have irrigation, what happens to the land? It may go back to dry land farming, which is still done at growing crops without irrigation. They may stop at farming altogether and just sell out to wind farms. We don't know where the landscape is going.
So that area is very nice for wind farms.
Yes.
I mean, I know I go to Dallas a lot by airplane, and you get to Fort Stockton, and
right.
you look down, and it's just amazing over
sure.
a short space of time.
Yeah.
And so the high plains are a good place for that.
Oh, very much so.
So maybe that is an answer.
Yeah.
You realize that the wind farms are having a major impact on bird populations.
It depends who you talk to. I'm not the expert there. Some say it is, some say
well,
it's...
supposedly there's the golden eagle in California is threatened. It just shows that any time, you know, there's no free lunch.
Right.
In California, one of the issues with the water is the snail darter,
mm-hmm.
as you know.
Sure.
This is a small fish that might be damaged if they did certain things. And so you're going to come up with this tension between people and environmentalists and so on and so forth. And how do you deal with that?
I complain like the rest of you.
Let's go back to the possibility of no agriculture in the High Plains in 10, 20 years in some aspects. Does the state of Texas have an organization that is sort of looking deeply at this? And the reason I bring it up is because 15 years ago you could have read in newspapers in Dallas, and you did, that El Paso was going to run out of water
oh, sure.
in 15 years. And now we are almost self-sufficient. You know, we've got the desalination program. We've got the tertiary recycling of water. I wouldn't say we're flush with water, but we are in very good condition.
Good for you.
Well, I mean, yeah. it's good for our water
sure.
people. But,
yeah.
I mean, it's a transformation. But in this case, this is not for people. This is for agriculture, which is an enormous, bigger pool of water needed and absent.
One of the reasons we're running out faster is a lot of farmers move to corn after the subsidies increased a few years ago. And corn takes a lot more water than the cotton that it was replacing, and they're pumping just as fast as they possibly can.
So it's the business, let it be one more big positive round and then we'll retire?
Economics.
I think, yeah, let's have a good 10 or 20 years and that's the end of it.
This is one of the arguments, too, when you get into transportation fuels about biofuels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of those corn crops were, you know, planted because of ethanol, and that whole thing is bust right now at this point.
It is?
Oh, yeah. The
and yet our petrol is, I mean, our gasoline is still 10% ethanol.
Well, I mean, it's still that it was going to make a bigger impact, and then you got into this food versus fuel crisis.
Right.
There was this problem on the border here where the price of tortillas went through the ceiling, corn tortillas, and it really is geography and economics and really policy.
Jeff, you know, you're looking from where dust emanates, right? That's fascinating by itself.
Sure.
The idea is you go back and look at these hot spots and, you know, the principle underlying looking
for trying to see if there are similarities. Around here, it's most of the dust seems to come out of the dry lake basins.
So presumably this idea that some of the cemeteries are raised is because they weren't tilled.
Because they were not farmed where all the land around it was.
Let's get on a plane and go out there and look right now. That's fascinating.
What are you going to look for?
Old cemeteries.
Yes. Yeah,
and then when you found an old cemetery, let's just pursue it a little bit. What would you do when you get to an old cemetery? First of all, you get permission from some church to go digging around, right? Then what?
Oh, don't need to dig.
No, you don't need to dig.
Look at elevation changes. It's a very flat landscape.
Right.
So it may be 3 feet higher. I don't know if that much, but 2 feet or...
And I'm not saying that's the case.
Oh, so it's just what you're saying is an example of if you leave the land alone, it doesn't erode.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've got more examples. What do you do?
But this is just information. It's just information.
Well, we know it, apparently. You know, you've all agreed. There's cemeteries all over the place.
I think he said this is a rumor that needs to be confirmed.
Right. That would just be another example of how much erosion
if
had occurred.
The listeners can participate in that. I mean, I'm sure people out there know of little towns in West Texas, southern New Mexico, all over.
Sure.
And they'll say, oh, yes, I remember down in Andrews or La
Mesa
or something.
Yeah, I can imagine that people had photographs from the 30s, and maybe there's a photograph today, and you can actually see it.
Maybe we should ask the people out there if you're
listening. Start writing the paper, Keith. This is
this is really, I can see it already.
I would love to hear from them.
We've just got a few minutes left. Let's look at the recent history of agriculture and lack of rain. Australia seems to be having a terrible time of it.
Yeah.
From all of the aspects that you've talked about with the summer and the fires, too.
Fires, water, fires, dust.
Australia is going through a nasty drought, and I don't know if anyone knows just why.
But I think it's interesting that, you know, you write down these three factors, and so many, like in the case of Haiti we talked about, in the case of Australia, is it always the case that if we're not ready for this variation in Mother Nature's cycles, then things that we do make these situations worse? I understand the Australian situation. It is the farmers that are really exacerbating the situation.
I don't know that, and I don't want to be on a radio show where that is expounded. I got a lot of good friends in Australia. I've not read anything about that. I've read about
families that were exported for crimes years ago from England.
I'm going to stay out of this discussion.
It's such a big topic that I don't really think we sort of got involved in any profundity in any area, which is in fact very typical of many scientific and socio-scientific activities. So
absolutely.
You'll have to come back, I'm afraid, Jeff, at some other time and go through a little bit more of a litany of where you've had success that can be perhaps applied. But that's another story.
With pictures of the cemetery.
With pictures of cemeteries.
So that's it. That's another Science Studio. Thanks, Jeff, for being on the program. Thank you, Norma, for putting it all together. Thank you, Russ, for being here today. And we thank the audience for being here today, too. And we'll see you all next week. Bye-bye.
I'm Fernanda Tejeda with your Synapse Flash. In mid-May, Governor Rick Perry signed a bill establishing the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center at El Paso as the fourth institution under the Texas Tech University system. Dr. Ted Mitchell has been named interim president over the El Paso campus. A national search for permanent president will be launched. Read more at the region's Life Sciences News Digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.